With that, it is our honor to invite Sayyid Ali Naqi Zaidi, who is going to be addressing the believers tonight. He is going to be speaking about the Hozawi contribution to global research in the humanities and Islamic sciences. We invite him with a salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala سيد الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب إله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم والصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين واللعنة الدائمة على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى يوم الدين. I would like to begin my talk today with thanking Almighty Allah for giving us the opportunity to experience the spiritual months of Rajab and Sha'ban once again, and I pray to Him for forgiveness of our sins and for the deficiencies that we have and for forgiving our shortcomings, as taught by the Imam, Allahumma in lam takun ghafarta lana fima madha min sha'ban faghfir lana fima baqiya min. And with this, I also pray that when we enter the month of Ramadan, we enter in a state of spiritual purity, so we are able to benefit to the maximum from the bounties of Allah Subhanahu wa ta'ala. Please recite a salawat. So before I begin the topic that was announced, Hozawi contributions to global research in humanities and Islamic sciences, I would like to offer an introduction, a foreword about media and its nature, and then I'm going to go towards that topic. So we all know that Allah Almighty, when He sent the prophets, He sent them with miracles, right? So each of the prophets had a special miracle. So we all know since childhood, Prophet Isa, he could heal the lepers or the sick, he could cure the sick. And then Prophet Moses, he had a few miracles as well, Yadi Bayda, and he and the famous story, the competition with the magicians, and he could turn his staff into a snake. And then the Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Quran itself is a miracle and his best miracle. When we talk about miracles, the usual understanding in theology, in Kalam Islami, as most of you are tulab here, is that miracles, when we ask why were the prophets given the miracles, so the answer is because Allah wished for the people to know that this person who's brought the miracle is from Allah Almighty. And that's something extraordinary that no ordinary person can do. So that's why we need miracles. But I think there's another aspect to miracles other than convincing people that the person who's bringing the miracle worker, is coming from Allah. And that aspect is concerns media and the spread of the message. So imagine if you are today, even in contemporary times, if you would like to, if you are sick, God forbid, or if someone close to you is sick, and you are seeking a cure, so you are asking around your relatives, your contacts, tell me about a doctor who can cure this and this illness. And that doctor might be famous for curing that illness, XYZ, and you would be convinced to, if the doctor is really good, you would be convinced to travel far away to another town, to another country, you would be happy to do that, to get cured. So I can now imagine if Prophet Isa could heal the lepers, if this was a disease that was rampant, if this was a disease that was that couldn't be cured, and the Prophet Isa had this ability to cure this disease, and if he had this ability to bring back to life people from death, bring them back to life, this news, the news itself of this miracle would have reached far away and to different towns around the place he was residing in. So whenever he used to do this miracle, I can imagine that this would have reached quite far away, and this would have helped, and this could have been a vehicle for his message. And when we come to, for example, the example of Prophet Moses, in that story, the day of the competition, the time of the competition, it was fixed beforehand, the competition with the magicians. And it seems, because of the circumstantial evidences, that it would have been a very festive mood at the time, and people would have participated in that competition, coming from faraway lands. So it seems that the miracle that the Quran talks about had a media aspect to it, an aspect of tabligh, an aspect of spreading the message. Maybe the revelation was trying, through the miracle, it was trying to spread the message. That this was one of the ways for spreading the message. Similarly, for the Quran, in the case of the Quran, that is very apparent, because before the prophethood of Hazrat Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Arabs were known for poetry. They were known for a very rich oral tradition, and then literacy, reading and writing, wasn't very developed. So all their communication, their media was this poetry, eloquence, literary devices, all of these. So Quran, when the Quran is revealed, it uses this framework of the society, this media of the society that already existed, and then uses it as a vehicle for relaying its own message. So from here on, I would like to say that the revelation of Allah has a tradition of using the existing frameworks of the society that the society uses for transferring the messages, the form itself, the form of poetry, the form of seeking a doctor, and then uses it to spread its message. So this gives us an indication to use the existing frameworks of transfer of knowledge, transfer of ideas in our own times. Now there are different types of media, right? So there are popular media, mass media, all of the people are using that media. So at some time, the mass media, the popular media, for example, was radio. People were exchanging their ideas through radio. There were a lot of radio programs, a lot of consumption of radio programs. But then there was a technological development, and then we had the advent of television, and a lot of people were, or a majority of the people were using television. And now, for example, we have social media. So the media changes its form across time, due to technological developments, due to other factors, but the media is, for all of the segments of the society, the media consumption is not the same. So for example, right now, even though we are saying that social media is the principal media, for example, if that is the case, but still there are people out there who are, for example, from those who are very old, they would still like to read newspapers, right? So, and then there are people who communicate, who consume, for example, music. So a lot of people listen to music. That's a media as well. And then the religious people, they like to go to majalis, and that's a media as well. But not all of the segments of society are going to majalis. So there are different medias in a certain time. And take the example of painting. So a painter paints a picture, and then there are people who praise that, who appreciate painting. Someone like me, I cannot understand what a painting is about. So it looks like a scrub of paint. So by the same token, there is a... now I would like to shift to my topic. There is a media out there that I believe is being neglected by the Hauzawis, and because one of the job descriptions of a Hauzawi is tabligh. Right? So if you read that book by Ayatollah Khamenei, I forget its name. So he says that there are three haythiyat, there are three wazaif that you have. So one of that is tabligh, right? So each of us, I know, is concerned about tabligh. But there is a media that is being consumed by a particular segment of the society that we are ignoring. And that is the media, I would argue, the media of research articles, academic production being done in universities, and academic conferences, books being written in the academia. So I would like to focus on that in a few minutes. But before that, there are two specific traits of media that I would like to point out and then apply to these academic research as well. So please recite a salawat. So the principal duty or the function of media is to transfer ideas, exchange of ideas, that's the principal function. But media does something else as well. And in our case, in the case of academic research, that is more profound. So what media does is that it creates authority, right? So if you, for example, you have a Instagram page with a million followers, you have authority over your followers. Right, so if you give them a message, more likely if they're an engaged audience, more likely than not they'll listen to what you have to say, at least in part. So you have some authority. Similarly, artists or those who are, for example, painters or actors, celebrities, television reporters, newscasters, columnists, they all have authority, a particular level of authority in the society. Be Farsi harf shenavai daran. Yeah, they have influence. Ta'sir daran harf shenavai daran beharat. So in the case of academic research, that becomes very profound. So in academic research, although the main objective is fact-finding. Research itself is fact-finding. You are having a problem and you're trying to solve a problem, and you are trying to offer a solution to a problem. So that's what research is. So it's on the first level, you don't seem to think that it has something related to media. What does fact-finding, what does problem-solving has to do with media? So if you are sitting in a corner of your library, and if you are sitting in a room, in an isolated room, in a library and doing your research, that doesn't have anything to do with media. But once you start publishing your works, once you start publicizing your works, that becomes media, and you are then becoming an authority in that subject. You are starting to influence people. So because of this, because of the ability to exchange ideas, because of the ability to transfer ideas and then to create authority, I think this is quite important. The idea of ilm being tied to authority can be found in our ma'arif as well, in the ahadith. So Ayatollah Khamenei, he often says al-ilmu sultan, and he is quoting a hadith from Sharh ibn al-Hadid of Sharh Nahj al-Balagha of Ibn al-Hadid. The actual hadith couldn't be found before Ibn Abi al-Hadid. And Ibn Abi al-Hadid, I believe, was in 5th or 6th century, I believe. But the hadith itself couldn't be found, but the idea is correct. So, al-ilmu sultan, ilm brings power, knowledge is power. So, in the context of Ayatollah Khamenei's speeches, it's usually scientific advancement, but using the same milak and same manat, we can extend it to other fields like humanities and Islamic sciences as well. So, if on the global stage, there are fields that require research in humanities, in Islamic studies, and you Hauzavis are the ones who are doing the research and then publishing your work, and people are listening to you, people are reading your works, then you have the ability to create authority for yourselves. Right now, I believe what I saw in last 5 to 6 years, we have been having a mubahatha, we had been having like discussions around the academic production, the production of academic works from Western universities concerning Shiism. So what we notice is that there are around 80 or a few more, 80 or above, people and academics who have done their doctorates and in Shiism, outside of Iran, they're outside of Iran, in universities across the world, and they are working on Shiism, and they're specifically working on Shiism, nothing else. 12 Shiism, in fact. There are people who are working on Ismailism, there are people who are working on Alawis and Bohras. What we are talking about is study and research surrounding 12 Shiism. So there are around 80 also figures who are asatid, they're university professors who are working over Shiism. Muslims and non-Muslims, right? But the key is that a majority or a vast majority of them have nothing to do with the Hauza. Now, at the first level, this might look like a scheme by the colonialism, by imperialism, whatever you would like to call it. But I think there is a room, and people have tried to penetrate that, infiltrate that. But nonetheless, there are a lot of shubahat in Shiism, the works being produced about Shiism. So for example, I would just like to give a few examples to show that this can be done, like you can enter into a dialogue with this environment, with the production of knowledge in humanities and Islamic studies, and specifically Shiism. And you can be influential, you can create your authority. I would give just a few examples, and to illustrate that there is a need and that this can be done. So, speaking of examples, there was an article written by a Jewish professor. He was from Tel Aviv, and it was written by him. And then he said that in the article, he showed that this idea that there are 12 imams came later after the ghaiba. So when you read that article, a common person who is interested in reading articles, so there is, to be clear, what I wanted to say was that there is a segment of society that consumes these articles, right? So apart from the academics, there are people who consume these articles, who are engaged with these articles, and they don't usually find their answers through manabir, through their regular tulab. So they are in a state of confusion. I every now and then I meet a few people who are influenced by these thoughts and they are reading these articles. So this article by this Jewish professor, he was proposing that the Twelver sect became Twelver after the Ghaiba, right? So they were in a crisis, and then the Imam was Ghaib, they didn't know what to do. And before that, there was the usual doctrine was that there should be an Imam for every time. But after the Ghaiba, suddenly the Imam was in hiding and they didn't know what to do. So they borrowed the ahadith from the Ahlul Sunnah about the 12 Imams, and then they made this 12-hour doctrine. So if a common person reads this article, he, I believe, falls into a state of doubt about the doctrine of 12 Imams. So myself and a friend of mine, we wrote an article about this Shubha, and there had been quite a lot of work in Iran and in Arabic, in Persian as well, about this whole idea, and they had responded very well. But the people outside of Iran, no one knew about these works. So what we did, we gathered all of these works and then we repackaged it. We didn't do a cutting edge research. We didn't go to the primary sources. We just repackaged it, right? So we made a new article. And we give the reports of all of these works that were already there in Farsi and Arabic. This paper was then presented at a conference in Canada. And then this friend of mine, he presented the article. And then the article was published in a journal. And then we uploaded it to academia.edu. Okay. So that's quite accessible with no special criteria. But then what we saw was that each day, it's not been a month. Today, it's not been more than a month. But each day we are getting hits and views from people all across the world. And there have been comments, people who have said that we read that work, which you are targeting. And then we were, for example, in a state of doubt. And then this work of yours have helped us. So this was one example. We, of course, weren't publishing in journals by Jewish authors or journals being published by Jewish universities. We published in a Shi journal, but this was still helping. Another example. I recently had the opportunity to write an article for I actually wanted to work on the tafasir of Ayatollah Khamenei, right? So I wish to study those, and I was seeking an excuse, bahane vayat boshadi. Then there was a call for papers from a university in Malaysia. So that university, I didn't know at the time, there was a call for papers. The conference was on Quran and Sunnah. So I thought this is a good excuse. And then I gave the abstract. The abstract was formed in a way that could be appealing to that side as well, to the Malaysians as well. So the abstract I wrote was that you have social tafasir, social exegesis, tafsir ijtima'i, you have that in Ahlul Sunnah. Sayyid Qutb being the most prominent. Fi dhilal al-Qur'an. And there are other Sunni tafsir ijtima'i as well. So, and Rehber Ayatollah Khamenei, he's doing tafsir ijtima'i as well. So, how does this Tafsir Ijtima'i fit into that Tafsir Ijtima'i being done by Ahl Sunnah? So this comparative work creates an appeal for a Sunni audience as well. The abstract word was accepted, and then I wrote the paper as well. And interestingly, Malaysia is a country which bans Shiism. Right? There are only one or two countries in the world that legally ban Shiism. Malaysia is one of those. And the people over there, the Shias over there, they are in strict taqiyah. So still this abstract and this paper was accepted. The university was an Islamic university, and they were known to be Wahhabis. And whenever I told someone having something to do with Malaysia that my abstract on this topic has been accepted, they were quite shocked. So they didn't know why that was accepted. But still it was accepted. And then I went and then I presented the paper in that university, and I didn't face any problems. So what I realized was the potential for this media, the potential for this vehicle of transferring of ideas and the exchange of ideas. So this offers a bit of freedom, right? So in that society, in that closed society where Shiism is a crime, I was able to present Tafsir Ijtima'i of Ayatollah Khamenei. And the tafsir that I offered over there was about Ayyamullah, the famous khutbah Jum'ah that he offered after the event of Ain al-Asad, and following the martyrdom of Qasim Suleiman, Shahid Qasim Soleimani. That was the tafsir I presented over there. I imagine many of the people over there in my panel didn't know that Ayatollah Khamenei is a mufassir, that he does tafsir. And the people I talked to over there were saying that in Malaysia, there is a general conception that the Shi'is have a different Quran and that they believe in a different Quran. So I think this allowed me to present a correct version of Shi'ism. And this media, this opportunity gave me the, like this framework, this media gave me the opportunity to present it. Anyway, so that was one example. So are there people who are working over this? Again, I'm going to give some more examples. So there is the question of whether Quran accepts Darwinism and evolutionary biology, and does the Quran accept that the humans were Adam and Eve were the descendants of another species, right? Or whether the Quran says that they came abruptly without evolution. So this debate has been renewed in the academia since 2021. Once again, it had been in the amongst the Muslims, but in the level of research and academia, it resurfaced in 2021 through a book by a person called Shoaib Malik. Shoaib Malik was a scientist in chemistry, specializing in chemistry, and then he changed fields towards theology. And then he wrote a book about Islam and evolution in the Ghazali paradigm, something like that. So he was offering the thesis that if Ghazali had been there, like alive right now, and using his theology, can we say that, can we accept that the humans were the descendants of some other species, and what the Quran has to say about this? And then there were a few articles written on this topic by Ahl Sunnah mainly, because they are the majority sect and they are in this field. So a lot of articles by Ahl Sunnah. And the perspective of Shi'ism was missing over here. although we have these debates amongst our scholars as well in Iran. So, two of the graduates of the Hawza, they wrote a paper on this, and they wrote a paper presenting the views of Allama Tabatabai and his students, such as Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli. So we recently had a conference about Tafsir Tasneem, and a group of organizers went to Ayatollah Khamenei as well. So this article presented the opinion of Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli and Allama Tabatabai as well. So again, these two people, these two students of the Hawza, non-Iranians, I'm specifically mentioning this example because they were non-Iranians, because non-Iranians have a specific potential to enter into these fields, I believe. So again, so they wrote this article which was actually reporting what Allama Tabatabai and Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli had said about evolution, about Quran and evolution. And their article, the article that they wrote, was titled Adamic Lineal Exceptionalism. So it was adding another opinion to the stream of opinions, to the spectrum of opinions that were present out there. This was giving another opinion. And I read that article. It was published in 2024, last year. That article, I believe, was a very good example of how you can enter into these fields, into these voids, and represent the Maktab Tashayyu. One more example. So this was these were non-Iranian students. If you would like to see this article, it was written by Fatima Merji and Ali Safdari. It was published in Routledge, a series on new frontiers in Islam and evolution, something like that. Again, I don't remember the exact words. Again, another example. So in the academia, again, about Shiism, the works being produced about Shiism, there are various shubahat about Vilayat Faqih, as there are in popular media. In the academia, there are quite a lot of shubahat about Vilayat Faqih. How did it come about? A lot of people saying that this was because of Ayatollah Khamenei's Irfan, and that he brought Irfan into fiqh. It didn't have a prerequisite or a predecessor in fiqh, and doesn't have anything to do with fiqh. And there are other theories as well. So one of the ulama and one of the scholars, Muhammad Saeed Bahmanpour, along with another researchers, Saifuddin Kara, they wrote a paper on legal something along these lines. Legal authority of the jurist, and its scope in modern Iran. And this paper deals with all of these misconceptions, and then clearly shows that this whole idea had a predecessor in Shi'i fiqh and in Sunni fiqh as well. And clearly shows what Imam Khomeini's innovations were, what his creative ideas were, and then locates it into the Shi'i fiqh and Shi'i jurisprudence. So these are quite a few examples, I believe, that show that this vehicle, this media can be used, and people are using it, the Hawzavis who have tried to use it. And I believe non-Iranians, people like us, we are better situated, better placed to use this, and because the Iranian works, first of all, there are problems of translation, but that has been compensated to a good extent because of AI. But still, when you read that stuff, it's like a lot of the work is in the Iranian context with a Irani zehniyat-e Irani. you need to know what's going on out there in the academic field. So this example, this Adamic lineal exceptionalism, the article that I mentioned, it enters into a dialogue with what's already out there, and then situates the opinion of Allama Tabai amongst all those views. So this is important, to be able to situate your views in what is out there and to offer a comparison with what's already out there. So I think we are better situated, we are better placed. There are various forms of tabligh, this is one form of tabligh. So these were a few examples, but if you would like to work on these topics and we would like to... Is 40 minutes up? Okay. So if you would like to enter this field, if you would like to work on this, I think there are quite a few topics that are present in Iran and that can be worked upon. And there is a need outside of Iran. There was another, actually, when I went to Malaysia, there was another topic that I came across, and that was Islamization of knowledge. So before, even before the revolution, some of the Sunnis, they were worried about the sciences coming from, the secular sciences coming from the West. So they were in this, they had this dagdagh, this passion for Islamization of knowledge. So a lot of them were working on this even before the revolution. And then the university I actually went to in Malaysia was founded on this principle. This was the real project, Islamization of knowledge. And it's quite interesting, when I went over there and I spoke to different professors over there, do you know something about Islamization of knowledge in Iran? Because after the revolution in Iran, Islamization of knowledge, Al-Medini, this was a big project. And a lot of institutions were following this project in Iran. Moses Imam Khomeini being the best example, there were quite a few others. When I asked them, do you know anything about Iran? Do you know anything about Islamization of knowledge in Iran? They had no clue. And if you read their works, absolutely no reference of anything in Iran. And this was surprising. Two Muslim countries working on the same project, having no knowledge of each other. So this was one field that I could identify. This is one topic. So another topic, for example, that we can work upon is, I think the foundations, Iranians are really good in foundation building, in philosophy, in epistemology. There are fields out there that can be related in some way. You have to make it relevant to that. For example, there is epistemology in the Western philosophy. You can make the epistemology being taught over here relevant to that. There are, for example, debates of science and religion in Iran, and I believe there are quite a lot, and there have been very deep philosophical discussions about science and religion in Iran, which people outside of Iran have no knowledge of. So we can repackage that and give it out. Then there are debates about Irfan, Tafsir, a lot of things that can be again turned into a academic language and offered to that special segment of societies outside of Iran that have a taste for these type of articles, and their main media of consumption is academic research. So with this, I hope that inshallah, if God gives us the tawfiq, we are able to utilize this opportunity. I think it can be done, and we need some work to do. And I would like to end my talk with the dua that inshallah, when we enter the Maheh Ramadan, we enter with a state of purity, and we are blessed by Almighty Allah, inshallah. Thank you very much. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.